This is Fragmented, an Android developer podcast where we talk about building good software and becoming better Android developers. I'm Don Felker.
And I'm Kaushik Gopal.
Welcome to this week's show.
Before we begin today's show, I want to take a quick moment and thank our sponsor, Hired.com. You know, it's a good time to be a software developer, but it's an even better time to be an Android developer. I'm not just saying that because most of our listeners are Android developers, but really, the demand for Android developers today is pretty high. So the question is, okay, I'm an Android developer, how do I find a good job? Well, that's where Hired.com comes in. As soon as you sign up, you can get interview requests within a week. And each of these offers come with a salary and equity upfront. So you know in advance if it's even worth spending your time on these interview requests. They also work with over 3,000 companies, from startups to large public companies. So they have a really nice extensive pool from where you can get all these great offers. Now, signing up for Hired.com is totally free for you as a user. You don't pay anything. If you do land up getting a job through them, they give you additionally a $1,000 bonus just to say thank you. So that's great. But if you're a listener of the show, you deserve something extra special. So sign up with this special link, hired.com/fragmented. When you do that, they double that bonus. So instead of $1,000, you get $2,000 when you accept a job. So if you do sign up with them, please do sign up with our special link. And they know that you came from us and you'd help support the show. Thanks again to Hired for sponsoring today's show. Hello, hello.
You know, I don't even know where to tell you the truth. It's weird starting off like this. For the listeners, we're trying something new this episode out. We're introducing something, we're kind of internally. We're a company or something, right? Called the Decompress episodes, or we're kind of decompressing. But long story short, where you understand that some of our episodes are pretty technically intensive in terms of content. So what we have noticed, though, is on those few times that me and you have gotten together in San Francisco, New York, wherever, that we have ended up having conversations just kind of about like, hey, I'm doing this thing in RX. Does this sound right? Or am I doing this like completely the wrong way? And maybe you'll ask me a question and it kind of goes back and forth. And before you know it, we have like a few people that have amassed around us and we've kind of building this larger conversation and people find it very interesting. So I'm not saying that we are the best conversationalists in the world, but people have said, you know, this is the kind of stuff that you guys should have on the podcast. So we're going to try a couple of these episodes out to see how it goes. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, that sounds right. And as is always the case, if folks have feedback on things we can do to improve the way we are structuring these episodes, or if they think it's a good idea, if they think it's a bad idea, then we are all ears. So do let us know.
Yeah, so there's not really going to be a lot of format to these episodes, really. It's just kind of us chatting about stuff that's Android developer related in one way or another, or things that we've noticed, and we'll just kind of let it roll.
Yeah, that makes sense. But before we start today's Decompress episode, I do have a quick bit of follow-up that I want to cover. In episode 32, so this is basically the fragment that I released on trying to make sense about the Android support library version numbers.
Oh, yeah.
In the comments, we actually got two listeners give some great feedback. So Jan pointed out in the comment that actually I did make a mistake. So In my rage about how the naming conventions are completely messed up, I did mention that AppCompat technically should have been AppCompat V9 because the support goes back all the way to Gingerbread, which is 9. I didn't actually test it out myself. I made that assumption from an intro blog post that one of the other folks from the support library teams actually mentioned. So I looked at that and I was like, what the hell? This should be AppCompat V9. Why didn't you just name it like that? But our listeners were, as usual, super sharp. And they pointed out that actually AppCompat does go all the way to V7. And Jan actually tested it and he actually got the error. So if you try to put a min SDK version of 6, it'll actually fail. And if you change your min SDK to 7, it actually goes through. So that was my bad. I think that was, I didn't test it. Anatoly went one step even further and he actually pointed us to the GitHub link directly where they actually do point where what the min SDK version is. So that was amazing. I just thought that was really cool and I wanted to give a shout out to those two good listeners who made sure that they followed up with the right information. So just putting that information out there.
Definitely. Big thanks to that. We appreciate it very much.
We do.
So you had told me a couple of days ago that you had at work, you got to be part of a iOS boot camp. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. So for a brief period of time, I went into the dark side. I mean, the true story is at Instacart. So a couple of the folks from my team who work on iOS, they were running this small boot camp. This was just to encourage other engineers in our team to sort of get a feel of how mobile development is. So the iOS folks actually set up a boot camp and just to show support and also like for my team members. And also I was always just curious to see how things in the iOS development world are. I actually went in for the boot camp as well. Man, there were some things that I didn't even realize. Like, people don't really understand like how nice Android Studio is and like, you know, how things can get really bad. For example, with Xcode, I was chatting with a couple of like my colleagues and the folks there, and Xcode crashing is like a regular thing. So like every 3 days, 4 days, they're like, oh yeah, it could possibly crash, just like restart it and all, everything will be fine. And I'm like, wait, what? And I kept trying to think about the parallel. Very rarely does Android Studio crash on me. We have it really nice with Android Studio compared to stuff like Xcode.
Did you ever use Eclipse back in the day for Android?
I have used Eclipse, but not for Android development. So I feel your pain partially, but I've heard it was really bad with...
Yeah, it's a whole other world of hell, really. there's a lot of people that love Eclipse. You probably listen to the show, and I'm sorry if I offended you, but I have this huge disdain for Eclipse. And that's the way it kind of was really early on, like literally the first couple releases of Android, the ADT plugin would... Something would work and all of a sudden it just wouldn't compile or the resources wouldn't be there. And you're like, I have no idea what's wrong. This code looks correct. It matches the sample. And then you would restart Eclipse and then all of a sudden it magically would work. And you're like, oh, great, thanks. And so a lot of times you'd get to this weird situation in your development cycle where you're like, okay, you know, hack away on some code. And then all of a sudden you get this red squiggly line or it wouldn't compile. And you're like, okay, I don't know if it's me or the code. And so you just, part of your regular cycle was just restarting Eclipse. So I can imagine the pain in Xcode, definitely. But I didn't know it was still that bad.
Yeah, I mean, and this is like pretty recent. This isn't 6 months back or something. This is as good as like 2 or 3 weeks back. So I was super surprised. But just to be sure, I'm not saying we shouldn't complain even if Android Studio like gets a little flaky, because we expect super high standards, right? And that's one way of enforcing it. Like if you care that much about your tools and you keep... complaining isn't necessarily the right word, but like constructive criticism, right?
Politically correct.
I mean, we expect the highest quality tools. And so I think it's completely fine to complain about things that don't work in our way. But I just want to take a moment to, again, thank the good folks at the tools team, because like we have it definitely better.
Oh, yeah. I remember when I first learned of IntelliJ and they had an Android plugin in IntelliJ. I didn't know at the time, and a colleague at the company I was working at showed me, and I immediately jumped over to IntelliJ and was just extremely happy over in IntelliJ once I got away from Eclipse. But I have to agree with you here that when the announcement was made, the Android Studio was basically built on top of IntelliJ. I was like over the moon happy, excited. So speaking of boot camps, how long was that boot camp?
I think it was maybe half a day, if I remember right. Again, it was tuned to our engineers. So, I mean, like many of the engineers who were attending were pretty senior engineers. So, they didn't go into necessarily the basics as regular boot camps were. It was sort of like an accelerated boot camp where like it's only the things that are different about iOS that we covered. I will say one thing. Swift is really nice, but Objective-C, it's as hurtful to the eyes as it always has been. It's like crazy talk. Like, you know, people complain about Java and verbosity in Java. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, look at Objective-C. Like, I mean, I don't have it. You cannot complain with a straight face about Java when you have Objective-C looking like that. So anyway, we don't want to go into the holy wars.
Next week, Kaushik is starting a new podcast called The Apple Show. I will not be a part of it.
With a grand total of one listener.
Are you counting yourself?
Yeah, myself. That's it.
Speaking of boot camps, have you heard of, you know, and I'm sure people in the Silicon Valley have heard of this, but have you heard of the boot camps where people go and they like learn mobile development and then just try to go get a job? Have you heard of those recently?
I have. There are a couple of few. I don't remember the names specifically, but there are. Yeah, I mean, that is a thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So I remember, I mean, have you heard of the cost of some of these things though? Do you know how much they cost?
I imagine they are not like a $50 coupon or something that you get free on the internet. They're definitely pretty costly. At least that's what I've heard. But yeah.
The ones that I have seen range anywhere from like the low end, which was like $8,000. Like, and I've heard them go all the way up towards like $30,000 to $40,000.
Oh man. And, so this is almost like a degree kind of thingy, right? I mean.
Yeah, but I would be very leery of these things, you know, because it's like kind of like picking up the book at the bookstore, you know, like, teach yourself programming in 24 hours. You know what I mean?
Hmm.
Like, there's only certain so much you can get out of it. And I have a feeling that a lot of people might be getting duped a little bit, which is kind of a sad thing. And I think a lot of that's starting to come out in the tech news, that folks that come out of these boot camps really, you know, they can do some things, but they can't do as much as their employers are expecting them that they can do, you know, if they've been kind of
interesting. I guess it depends on expectations though, right? Because most folks, like,
it does.
They're like some super smart folk that just want to make a transition to the career, and then they go into these boot camps. Because I have heard success stories as well. So,
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I know this guy on this other forum that I'm part of, and he is a doctor, you know, a medical doctor. And he just got tired of the medical industry. And he's like, you know what? I'm writing my own. He's actually doing web stuff, but, you know, I taught myself Rails or whatever, and I've created this, you know, software as a service application, and he's, you know, changing his career. And so,
wow,
one of those situations where, like you said, they're smart and can get stuff done.
Yeah. I mean, so there's a very slim chance that you'll be recruited as a senior software engineer just with your experience from these boot camps. So that expectation has to be set down. So
as long as you can write left padding and publish it to NPM, you should be all right.
Put a library up there, get it up on GitHub or NPM. You're super famous. The next thing you know, you pull it down and then you break half the internet, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
Oh, boy. So speaking about IDEs, Android Studio, and all this stuff, these are like really smart senior Android engineers that, you know, I highly respect. I've seen many of them don't use Android Studio's like layout preview. I was curious and I wanted to bring it up with you. Do you use the layout preview, Android Studio's layout preview, as you develop your UIs, or are you just straight up fully, like, have you become so accustomed to just how the XML would turn out that you don't even need the layout preview and you go straight up into Java?
Dude, I'm in the matrix. I just see XML and it turns into code, you know?
You just visualize it in your head and then it just, like, as you see, it just translates into XMLs with perfect gravity and layout attributes.
Yeah, just like little characters, little bracket tags is just coming down. So, no, anyway, the clarification on that. Do you mean, there's actually two different previews you can look at. There's like the designer, you could treat that as a preview, and then there's like the preview panel. Which one are you talking about?
Oh, no, I mean the preview panel. I don't mean it. The usual tab, text, and design, which I think more often than not, almost 90% of us have it switched to text permanently.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean that preview. I don't mean editing the layout in the design preview mode. I mean just seeing the preview window side panel thing.
Okay, yeah. The reason why I asked that is because some people use that designer as a preview, and I've seen that happen. So to answer your question, yes, I do use the preview, so the preview panel, and have the XML open and edit it. So I've been doing that for as long as I can remember. And I remember when it was first announced, I was just elated over the moon. So yeah, I'm surprised that you've encountered a lot of people who haven't used it.
Me too. So, I mean, I'm like, right now the count is like 4 or 5. And these are not just regular, like, these are really super smart Android engineers. And almost all of them told me they don't even use the layout preview. And the reason I thought this was interesting is because I swear by this thing, especially I like how there's a toggle right on top where you can say show the preview for a whole bunch of devices. So you can have like tablets, you can have like old devices thrown there. And granted, these aren't super accurate, but they're accurate enough to be constructive for you to move forward in your development. So you're saying, I guess, at this point that you do use it as well. So
yeah, I do use it.
Yeah, maybe we should try to find one of these people that don't use it and try to like pick their mind and see what the rationale there is.
I use it, and I treat it kind of like follow the whole 80-20 rule. 80% of, I trust it for 80% of what I think is going to happen. Like right now, I'm looking at a view for a client app, and I was developing a recycler view item, like kind of like a row. And I've used the preview all this morning developing it. And I kind of believe that it's going to be pretty accurate. And then I'll just, you know, kind of run it on an emulator or a device or whatever, just as the last few sanity checks and last few tweaks. Is that what you do too? Or do you do something different?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah. No, that's my exact flow. So 80% of the way, I'll just get there looking at the layout preview. And then the last 20%, obviously, there are certain tweaks that you just have to get it up on the emulator or something. And I take it from there.
So speaking of looking at XML and a bunch of code, you sent me a message on Slack this week saying that you had to bump up your font size because I used to give you some crap about that when I saw you in New York City.
That is true. And I felt a little ashamed because I don't know if it's maybe just age taking its toll on me or something, or maybe it's just my sanity coming back to me. Maybe this is like a bad habit that I picked up as a kid. Essentially, what I used to do is I used to make my font size as small as humanly possible where it would be legible enough. And at the same time, I would also like my screen resolution, I used to keep it super small. And I guess my rationale there was I need to see as much as I can see of like the code. So if I have a file open, just to get good context, like I need all of the stuff to be visible. And so I bumped up the font size and life got like 5x better just immediately. And I also wanted to bring it up with you because I feel also my ideas of like development have changed, because now I've gone to the other edge, right? So at any point of time when I'm coding, I only want to see a small method in front of me that takes care of things, right? I don't want to see, actually, I feel it's detrimental to have to think about more than what's just right in front of you. So I thought that was interesting. And I don't know, maybe this is like a revelation that hit me way too late. And this was your motive all the way. Because I remember you were the one who mentioned, you said to just bump up your font size. And then I'm telling you, your life will get significantly better. And you were totally right. It just took me maybe like 8 months to realize that.
Yeah, I didn't start that way. I was the same as you. I would try to shrink everything down. I mean, make everything as small as possible on the screen, highest resolution, so I could have everything. I wanted all the context. And then one day, this is probably, man, like 2003 or 4, maybe a long time ago, when I'm at work and I can't look at the screen. Like, imagine sitting there looking at the computer, writing some code, and all of a sudden, like, the screen just starts going back and forth. And I'm like, I'm not even moving. Like, what's going on? Like, wow, like, did someone spike my drink? Kind of thing. And I look away and I kind of look outside the window and my vision's fine. And then I'm like, that's weird. And I go back to work. And 5 minutes later, the computer starts shaking again. And it's my eyes. And I did a bunch of research and found out it was a couple of things. It's A, because usually you're tired, which I probably was. And then B, because I was straining my eyes too hard. And so I just found like, all right, well, take the font size and bump it up by 2 or whatever until it was comfortable. And at first it felt like I was like I had a jitterbug phone. You remember those commercials, like the jitterbug phones?
This holiday season, complicated is out. Simple is in.
yeah, I do.
I felt like the developer with a jitterbug phone, you know, and I'm like, you know, like I need big fat buttons or something. I'm like, oh man, this is so embarrassing. But then eventually I realized like, I don't need to see that image view or whatever else is 12 lines up. I'm not focused on that right now. I don't need to see my entire file structure. Like this is all, what's happening is it's sensory overload and there's too many inputs going on. And so as soon as I eliminated that, it was much better. And so now I have a couple of, for example, in Android Studio, I'll have a couple of preferences settings. What's it called here? The schemes set up. And I call mine like Dark Yellow Plus. And then I'll create a new one. And then I'll use I use the Menlo font is what I default to. And I have the size 14 as my font. I don't know. What do you use? Do you know?
Spent way too much time, probably more than what people would deem healthy. I usually switch between two fonts. The one that I primarily use is, and I think I mentioned this in a previous episode, so it's a Consolas.
Yep, I've used Consolas, yep.
Yeah, that's actually a font that was built by Microsoft. And the other one that I've been using recently is Fira Mono, which I think is an open source font that was released by the folks at Mozilla.
Oh, okay.
And it's very similar to Consolas. It's a little more stylish, so it has a little more character. Now and then if I get a little bored, then I switch. But by and large, it's only these two fonts. And I used to do 12. 12 used to be my regular font size. I've been bumping it up to 14 and 15. On Android Studio, there's this weird, that's one problem, at least with the whole IntelliJ line of editors. The font rendering is not entirely very accurate. There's basically like where you have to make sure that the SDK that's used for IntelliJ is basically 1.8, Java 1.8. There are some like minor annoyances with that, but I feel the font rendering is not perfect. So I bump it to 15 on Android Studio, but my terminal, iTerm, Atom, like the editor, all the other things, I basically keep it at 14. So it's pretty similar now.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty much right in the same ballpark. But yeah, so now ever since then, I rarely have, the only time I'll have like weird like eye issues is if I'm extremely exhausted for whatever reason, but it's makes life a lot easier too. And the other thing is like, it's another tip that I give people when they're doing this too, is if for some reason you're the kind of person that likes the light colored theme of your IDE, mm-hmm. which a lot of people coming from like .NET are used to Visual Studio, and Visual Studio has this very bright white theme, or at least it did when I was using it.
Or Xcode, right? Yeah, even Xcode's default is pretty white.
Exactly. And so what happens is it's so much light going into your eyes that it's overbearing. And so what I advise is to, at least in the code editor, you can go in and change the background color of the code editor. Assuming you still like that light colored theme, change the background color of the code editor to like a light brown or a light gray. And that will actually reduce the strain on your eyes too. All right. So just recently, I was running a new app for a client, a small client on the East Coast, and I noticed that I needed to write some tests because I was starting to lose confidence of what I was doing. Changes were starting to break, and I'm guilty. I didn't write the test first, but that's just kind of the nature of the beast, and I wanted to see what your thoughts on this were, because what I found is certain clients have a certain budget, and I can let them know, like, look, we can build this now and we'll get it done, but we're going to probably have a lot of bugs, or B, we could spend a little bit more money up front, build the test for it, make sure that we don't have as many bugs, and in the end it will be cheaper. And what I usually find is they opt for the first one, is that we don't want any tests, we just want this done as soon as possible. And then I started thinking, like, why is it so problematic to set up tests? It's not really that hard anymore. Android Studio and the file structure allow us to add tests fairly easily. And then I realized that the real problem lies in the external dependencies. And that's going to be the data for your app. That's going to be the API that you need to consume and so forth. What do you think about that? Have you ran into that situation before too?
Well, absolutely. So I have a couple of thoughts there. So the first one is, this is a little tricky because you primarily work as a consultant, right? I've rarely worked as a consultant, so I can understand where this might be a little different. I'm more and more convinced these days that I don't even ask if I should be writing tests. Like, I don't even tell them I'm writing tests. I just write, go ahead. Like, if I'm building a feature, I just write the tests. And sometimes it takes longer than they would assume that it should, like how long it should take. And I just tell them, no, it took that long. That's it. Because I found that the argument with testing, especially with people who don't develop or who haven't, and even people who haven't faced the pain of not having tests, it's a very hard argument to make. And you're basically going to a client and saying, would you like your product out in 3 days or would you like your product out in 1 week? That's all they hear. And I mean, I don't fault them for that, because it is their objective and their role as, I don't know, product managers or project managers to try and see how they can get the app out as fast as possible. So this was something that I heard Martin Fowler say in like a previous talk or something. I don't even convince them that we need to write tests. I just go and do it. I can take that liberty a little more just because I've been at the company long enough where they trust me to do things the right way. So they don't go crazy. Like if I go join and the very first day I just start doing that, well, it's hard, right? It doesn't seem like the right thing to do. So
yeah, I completely agree with you. And I think in your situation, that is the perfect thing to do. And even in, I have clients that are like that. For example, I'm doing some consulting for American Express right now. And there's no question over there that when you write code, you write tests. Like, that's just how it goes. Like, there's no ifs, ands, buts about it. But when I come to it from, like you said, like a consulting perspective, I have to come talk to usually, you know, CEOs of companies and convince them, like, look, we're going to spend a significant amount of money building this app. They realize it. They have a budget. And then I have to be able to say, all right, well, we can, like you said, we can get it done in 3 days or we can get it done in a week. And of course, it's not going to be that fast, but we're just hypothetically speaking. What ends up happening is I have to look at it from a business perspective too, because A, I may need this client because I'm trying to fill a pipeline of work that I need as a consultant, running a consulting career. And I say, all right, well, I can get you in for a week, and then you know, we're going to run into issues. And I'll let them know, saying, hey, if we don't have tests, we're going to run into bugs. It's going to be more expensive in the long run. But what they end up doing, just like you said, is they look at the bottom line. All right, how much is this going to cost? And is this something that that I can deal with, and or can we wait till later? So it's just a weird thing. I just wish that the problem of setting up external dependencies like the databases, the APIs and everything was an easier problem to solve than it is currently.
Right. And that to that point, one thing that I've found is I pay the piper upfront, and that's why any project, even if it's like relatively small, I just like add Dagger in without like any question. Because I found just having Dagger in there, like it makes it, again, it's not easy to your point. It still is a little more effort. It doesn't just come for free, but it's far more lower. The bar is far more lower to get external dependencies in when you have something like Dagger. It also just depends on how like you've coded it up to begin with, right? I mean, if you have not written your code in a way that lends itself easily to be injected using dependencies, then you're going to run into that problem, I guess, right?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it is how you've written it. And especially in consulting, you come in and you take over legacy code bases a lot of time. And you're just like, wow, like, I don't even know where to begin testing this thing. Like, it's impossible. And right. You talk to the other developers and you ask them like, hey, how do we, you know, test this? We're like, well, just fire up the app and test it. And they're like face palm time. Like, okay, all right, I got it. Okay, no problem.
It is testing. I mean,
can't argue that.
All right. And I guess the final topic that we're going to talk about today is one that I guess both of us are super excited about, and one that's very recent.
Yeah.
Google basically open sourced this library called Agera. You think I'm pronouncing that right? Agera?
Agera, Edge Era, I don't know. Agera.
Agera. Agera. And the interesting thing with Agera is essentially it's a reactive programming library for Android. So this is why it makes it really, really interesting. And the whole of the internet was up in arms yesterday. But I thought this was a very good topic to discuss. Again, I don't think we're going to go into the details of how Agera works and necessarily like the different constructs. We'll have an independent, I think it deserves like an independent episode where we do a more deep dive. But I'd like to talk about just the fact that Google brought this in, like how do we feel about it and like the different sort of thoughts. What were your first thoughts?
Yeah, my initial first thought, I saw reactive programming. I took a look at the example and I immediately, well, a little background before this, like this isn't a thing that Google created out of nowhere. This is actually, from what I saw, it's running in billions of devices already. It powers like Google Play movies and a bunch of other stuff. And they just decided to kind of say, all right, look, we've been using it. It works for us. You know, here it is, open source community. But when I did see it, I thought to myself, I'm like, wait a second. I'm like, this totally suffers from like not invented here syndrome. That was like the first thing in my mind. I'm like, why? There's so many other things that already do this. Why are we recreating the wheel here? And I wasn't trying to be negative. It's just my initial reaction to it. Did you feel anything of that at all?
I think the big, whole, huge, giant, white elephant in the room is like, well, we have RxJava. And At this point, I would find it extremely hard to imagine that the folks who worked on Agera haven't heard of RxJava, right? Like, there's no way in hell they haven't heard about RxJava. Mm-hmm. So I think the gut reaction for most people was like, wait, we already have RxJava. Like, what are you trying to do? Why you have another library, right? But obviously, once the first 5 or 10 seconds of like rage sort of settled down, then the more and more you think about it. For example, you did mention that this is something that they've always had in place, right? There were a couple of other points that I also like thought were super interesting. One is we should be encouraging this. Like, this is a huge thing for us in two ways. One, it means Google is thinking in the same direction, because the whole reactive programming is very, very different from imperative programming or like the regular kind of thinking. So the fact that Google has open sourced a library means that they're giving legitimacy to this argument that there is a place for reactive programming. And that actually made me super happy. And it was sad because I didn't see anyone sort of like celebrate that fact, right?
Yeah, reactive programming is completely different. I mean, folks at, you know, I spent a lot of time at Realm this last year, and I mean, Realm is built completely for reactive programming. And so there's a lot of people that are starting to hop into it. So it's cool that they're exposing it even more.
Now, there's a slight difference in that there's already a very mature library in place. let's think about the hypothetical situation, right? Like, what would we have ideally liked? Would we have ideally liked if Google just started using RxJava and then like got rid of this Agera thing? And do you think that was ever like a possibility?
I don't know. It really depends on how long that this Agera stuff has kind of been in Google. It may have been in there for so long that it kind of was just built internally, and then Rx kind of was coming up at the same time. And that's a very good possibility. And they're like, well, we already use ours. Let's stick with ours. And then Rx kind of took off in the community. And let's face it, Google is a very large enterprise. They're not a startup.
Exactly.
Things need to get done. There need to be standards. There has to be process. Otherwise, everything just falls apart in a large company. So there's so many possibilities of why this is chosen. But this really reminds me of the days when, remember when Volley was released, like open source?
Yeah.
So this is like a very much a Volley type of thing, in my opinion, because there's so many other tools out there that did what Volley did already, and in my opinion, way better, you know, and to this day, there's, you know, still tools that do a lot of things better in Volley. So I'm not saying that Rx is better than Agera. It does look very young at this point in time and solves a particular niche problem. It's interesting to see where this is going to go, because I'm not exactly sure yet.
There are some problems with RxJava, right? Like, and usually people are celebrating RxJava, but the learning curve is steep.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's no denying that. RxJava has a very steep learning curve. Even for us to this day, there are things that we discover that we didn't know before. You hear Dan Liu, you hear Jake Wharton, you hear all these like fine developers, and even sometimes they're debating decisions or should we go this route, should we go that route with RxJava? So clearly, it isn't something that's meant to be picked up easily, right? And that's a big ding against it. And if Agera makes this sort of reactive programming easier for people who are new to this sort of like paradigm or new to development in general, then I'm all for it. Also, there's the question of method count. Like RxJava has like a huge method count, and I don't know how cool Google will be with that.
Yeah, I mean, the whole method count thing, I could turn that into a whole episode itself, but
true.
I have different opinions than most people on that. Here's how I'm thinking about it right now, pretty much live thinking here. If I were to walk into a client and they had Agera, how would I feel about that? I don't know how I would feel. I'm not enough familiar with it. I think I'd be happy that there is some reactive stuff there. But at the same time, I wouldn't be able to harness my existing tool set to move fast, you know?
So how do we feel about Google open sourcing this versus if somebody else open sourced this, right? Now, historically, we have to understand Google has some excellent third-party libraries. There's no denying that. We use App Compat, the support libraries. I think they do a phenomenal job. They do one of the finest jobs in keeping this library up to date, giving functionality. They're doing a perfect job there. The difference is they have complete control over it, right? So Google is great about third-party libraries. They're not that great about open sourcing necessarily, right?
Yeah, it is. And I think I saw a comment on Reddit yesterday that said, someone mentioned this exact topic and they said, well, here's a case in point of why you guys are doing open source wrong, because someone said, look, there's this pull request that fixes this issue. And then the comment was from someone from Google that said, oh yeah, that's cool. It looks great. As soon as we pull it back down internally, then we'll push it back up. And someone's like, that's not how open source works.
I mean, that's totally true. Like Dagger is another example, right? When Dagger 1 was under the helm of Square, it was great. Like people would make public PRs contributions and you would know immediately if it was going in or if it was not going in, right? Which is not to say they would just simply accept anything that the community comes in, but they would be very good about having a reasonable discussion in the open saying, yes, this is our thought process and we think this would work, this won't work. Google, I don't think necessarily does the same thing. I'm not saying they should do the same thing because maybe it doesn't work for them. But we clearly have to recognize that this is a major fault on their end.
Yeah, but I'd also like to play devil's advocate too here. On Google's side, like, let's be honest, like Google is just comprised of people like you and I, and a lot of people that are in there, a lot of developer relations teams, a lot of people that are, I mean, I've worked with people that are on the engineering team in Android, and they're just regular people. And those people want a lot of these things to be open source. And what it comes down to is politics and legalities and lawyers that say, well,
yeah,
we
sure
can't let that be on open for XYZ reasons. It has to go through this legal process. And this is the case for a lot of companies. And I have a feeling that there's so much red tape that goes on behind the scenes that we don't know about and we will never hear about, that it's a lot of the reasons. And unfortunately, some of the dev relations teams take the brunt of that a lot, unfortunately. And so, A, good job to you guys for, you know, keeping your head up and smiling throughout the difficult process. But I do want to let other people know that we have to consider that while it may not be perfect and Google does need to do a little bit better job, there are some problems internally that they're probably having to work through that we're not aware of.
Right. And I do actually want to point out, as we speak, like Agera, Jesse Wilson, friend of the show, actually sent in a pull request. It was a pretty small pull request. And actually, that's the last pull request that I see where he's changed the default character set of HTTP.
Oh, yeah.
And they merged that in. So
we have to just let this kind of stuff evolve and see where it goes. The only tips that I would really like the Agera team to take home right now, given where they are, is from a learning perspective, you know, having written, you know, many books and tutorials and articles and magazines articles and all kinds of stuff. The one thing that I have learned is that you really have to start like stupid simple and then build up from there. So if you look at the example on the Agera homepage, which we'll put in the show notes, you'll see that there's like all kinds of stuff going on. Like when you look at it, you're like, whoa, like brain explode. Like I have no idea what's going on here. So if they broke it down a little bit simpler, like, all right, here is, you know, an example of you want to go from A to B. Here's how you're going to do that in Agera. Now let's build on that. And it takes more time to write that documentation, yes. But what that does is it drives user adoption because then more people can say, oh, I see how this works now. And I think that would be a good thing that they could implement, hopefully.
Do you think it's just the nature of like reactive programming that makes it difficult to sort of lend itself? Or do you think they can actually do a better job with these examples? Because I had a very similar thought with RxJava, right? I thought, well, I could write an intro blog series, but then Dan is obviously great at this kind of stuff, right? Like breaking down concepts. And I thought like, well, that's already there. So which is why I came with the examples repository where you have like small examples, real world examples that you can just adapt. But I'm not so sure, like, is it just that reactive programming is a complicated concept where like it's hard to explain it without going into some level of complexity?
I think it is a little more difficult to explain it because of the complexity. You know, it requires people to think a little bit backwards than what they're used to. They're very used to procedural stuff. And as soon as you kind of do this reactive thing, like, all right, well, now we're just going to kind of hang out and wait for things to happen. It's a completely different way than you have normally done things. So it does require an additional layer of explanation, which is includes some complexity, but you can break that down to where it's easy enough. You just have to find the right concepts to understand it. And what you also need to do is in most learning, you need to grab onto something that somebody already knows so you can show them this relation. It gives them this natural neural pathway to jump between saying, oh, I understand this. And then you show them, here's how you do it like this. Like, oh, I kind of see what's happening now. And it builds that learning pathway.
All right. So I think that was fun. If listeners want to reach out to you, Don, how do they do that?
My phone number. No, just kidding. Not happening. You're going to reach. Best way to get a hold of me, and I say this at conferences, is you can email me through my website, but if I probably won't get it back to you for a few days because it's just a backlog of email. So hit me on Twitter at Don Felker. But if you do need something longer form, you can definitely try to email me. It just be a little bit while before I reply. It's not no disrespect, just trying to catch up.
Yep, totally the same way. My Twitter handle is Kaushik Gopal, and more often than not, I'm much more punctual with my replies there. So feel free to hit us up there. Fragmented Cast is our Twitter handle for Fragmented Podcast. So if you shoot us a tweet there, we'll definitely reply there. Or we do have our contact form. So that's fragmentedpodcast.com/contact. And we do have a Slack channel as part of the Spec network. So feel free to hit us up there and we will get back to you.
Before we go, though, I'd really like to say thank you to this episode's sponsor, Hired. If you use the link hired.com/fragmented, you'll actually be able to double that initial $1,000 thank you bonus if you get a job through Hired, making it a $2,000 bonus if you accept that job through hired.com. Again, that's going to be hired.com/fragmented. Thanks a lot, Hired.
Thank you all for listening, and we'll catch you next week.